All right, we are ready to proceed. First, I've read all your papers, and it was a powerful experience for me. I felt I was learning a tremendous amount as I was reading them about our enterprise. I felt somewhat guilty reading them because I could see your struggle with the lack of clarity in what I had stated as my expectation from you. And at the same time, I could see desire to engage it. So it started me off thinking about what the enterprise actually is for me. I'm a Socratic at my core, in the sense of knowing that I don't know. I teach because I love to learn. I was a good learner. I think all of us are good learners. And if you really like learning, then the opportunity to keep learning in a university environment is just fantastic. And so I teach what I'm trying to master, both conceptually and practically, myself. And this idea of empathic argument is just, for me, the cutting edge. So as I was reading yours, your struggles with what I mean by it, some things clarified for me. First, go back to the Carl Rogers idea of empathy with the function, the emphasis on the phrase as if, where the idea of empathy is not that you become the other person, but that you allow yourself to think as if you are the other person. You allow yourself to feel as if you are the other person. You remain yourself. So in advocacy terms, this vision of Archibald Cox standing in front of the Supreme Court and making an empathic argument is not one in which Archie is arguing the other side. Everyone's perfectly clear what his position is. Nonetheless, he starts by stating the problem so empathically to the opposition that they have no choice except to accede to the fairness of his presentation and to listen. So that's the idea. And I realized as I was reading your papers that I could have said that to you so much more clearly. It's really the statement of the problem that I'm looking for as the key point of departure. Once you've done that, then you're bound to use all your argumentative skills to come the other way. So Becca said, could I find examples of empathic argument? And one that I would love to hit you with is, can you run it? Drop the lights. Yeah, see, this is not the right one. Hold on, this is not the right one. Yeah. How do we get there?
Hold the mouse.
Champion,
You get to choose what you want to do. Heads or tails? Heads. Heads. Okay. Who goes first? Let that bitch go first. Each of these cats, they're getting them to have a piece. You got it? Let's do it. DJ, look at that shit.
So what does he do? He's put himself in the mind of his opponent. He makes his opponent's argument right to him. And when he gets finished, he stands proud. It's a winner. All right, so lawyers don't do it just exactly like that. But the idea is right there. So Rebecca suggested that I take a shot and make an empathic argument myself. And I thought, well, all right, I'll give it a try. I'll give you a choice of topics. I feel very passionate about the confrontation clause. It's at a point in time when it's quite up in the air. And it involves quite fundamental issues, particularly issues relating to gender. That's one. A second is a note, did I put it out? Yes. Here, from this morning's paper. YouTube is purging copyrighted clips. Did you see this? Hitting the financial jackpot, it appears, may have created some headaches for YouTube, the wildly popular video sharing website that has agreed to be bought by Google for $1.65 billion in stock. When was this company formed? Amazing. The site last week began purging copyrighted material from Comedy Central, including clips from YouTube's stalwarts like The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, The Colbert Report, South Park. By the way, worth a mention, Nick Sylvester, who was here before, I don't think we mentioned that he's on the staff at Colbert Report now. Did we mention that? And there's a wonderful clip from our class that Ivygate, which is a blog that kind of covers Ivy League, clipped out of our democracy cut that's up there and put up on YouTube. I recommend it to you. It's just a segment of the class with me. So, YouTube did not respond to repeated messages left over the weekend. The situation is tricky for a network like Comedy Central, part of Viacom. Its audience is young and technologically sophisticated, and Comedy Central stars in the past have used YouTube and clip services to interact with their audience. Stephen Colbert, the Colbert Report, for example, gained great attention for his mocking speech before President Bush at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which became one of the most viewed clips at YouTube before C-SPAN, which broadcast the event, ordered it taken down. How many of you saw that? YouTube. Yeah, got it. In an interview with Wired magazine in September 2005, Mr. Stewart explained his view. We get an opportunity to produce this stuff because they make enough money selling beer that it's worth their while to do it. I mean, we know that's the game. I'm not suggesting we're going to beam it out to the heavens, man, and whoever gets it, great. If they're not making their money, we ain't doing our show. All right, so a choice. The Confrontation Clause or John Stewart? All in favor of the Confrontation Clause, raise your hands. All in favor of John Stewart, raise your hands. John Stewart it is. So here's my thought. My thought is, I'd like to have my feelings for John Stewart and Colbert, which are feelings of total admiration that these men have led this really remarkable opening in a movement towards a truer reality in the public communication sphere. I'd love to feel that somehow consistent with my devotion to the open world, that in fact they are largely championing. And in some way offer some possibility of an alternative future for them in which they break away from the existent copyright for-profit model and go beyond broadcast through some open form. So, were I talking to John and to Colbert, I'd say to them, yes, I understand your quote. I noted it was 2005. And back then, when you were on your way up, it was definitely true that as the world looked to you, you needed them more than they needed you. But I'd ask you to look and see where you've come. See if there isn't a moment in your future in which, if things were organized just slightly different, you might make a change. Just imagine all of the support that is out there in the world for you, the love for you that comes from the fact that you have led us so bravely closer to the truth. And suppose that support could somehow be harnessed in a flow back to you that would support the staff of 65, of which Nick Sylvester is one. Could you imagine going open? So, okay, that's a shot. Today we're going to meet Jake Shapiro. He's with PRX. This is radio coming up and out into this medium. And Steve is going to show you how to use an audio editor, the one he's particularly favored with. Tomorrow, Colin Rinesmith comes in, and we do a workshop on podcasting. I'd like to give you an assignment based on my having read your papers. I'd like to speak to the students in the Extension School, because this assignment, I think, will work for you as well. I want you to make an argument. Your argument. I want you to make it in an empathic form. I want you to make it in under 2.5 minutes. I want you to record it. I'd like some of you willing to come in here tomorrow and make your arguments to us right here in class so that we can workshop both the ideas of empathic argument and the methodology of recording them, putting them up and out. All right, so Jake Shapiro. Jake.
I think I need to do some kind of switcheroo.
Do switch. And Tim, is this a time to take a break? We'll take a break. Tim wants to change the tape, and Jake wants to shift around. The core of the Iliad is the rage of Achilles. He's in a rage at the king, Agamemnon, who's taken his war prize away in a way that insulted him. And the group, in fact, I've posted a video, which you can find on my Eon blog. The group discussed, and we recorded the discussion of insult by authority and the power of apology as part of an exploration of the connection between emotion and law. David was definitely a participant in this. And what it comes down to, and I think when you put this in the gender context, it is even clearer. What it comes down to is that the issue is one of equality. People want to be respected. So many disputes have to do with the way in which the power relationship is defined. If it's defined as one is in authority and the other is giving in, there can be a dispute because people do not like to be forced to give in. It runs against your sense of self-respect. On the other hand, it can be a relationship of equality in which the other is asked to give. Then the very thing which was being forced can be given in a way that makes for exchange and resolution. So many disputes involve understanding the way in which authority is conveyed from the side of the other looking toward it. It's the difference between ordering something, requiring it, coercing, and persuading. Persuasion is an art in which you ask the other to give. Jake.
Charlie.
Hey, Jake Shapiro. Formerly a director of the Berkman Center, fellow of the Berkman Center, came out of the Berkman Center with an idea for radio, bringing his background in radio together with his vision. And he's created something that I think is truly remarkable as an example of what it's possible to do in a short time with a good idea. Jake.
Thanks. And I guess by demonstrating PRX or giving a walkthrough of what the public radio exchange is, I'm hoping that it is an example of one of these new intermediaries in this sort of evolving media space that I understand is part of the course of study in this class. And I'll ask Charlie to help tie back some of the things I'm going to walk through into the themes you're going through. But the short form is that PRX, we're a nonprofit web service for distribution, review, and licensing of radio stuff. So we basically have this web platform that allows anybody to upload audio. And then we make that audio available primarily to public radio stations around the country. So in public radio, even though NPR is the sort of name brand you associate with all of public radio, it's actually independently operated local stations that decide what gets on the air and that goes out to what's now about an audience of 30 million people who listen every week to public radio, which has been a real success story of an audience growth over the last 20 years or so. And so PRX aggregates audio digitally that people can upload. We then make this big catalog available, and we decided that we needed to make sure that that had some context to it. So we have reviewing, where anybody can come on and write a review or rate the audio. And then the licensing piece regards the economy of it. So there's actually a marketplace aspect. So it's not just free and open distribution. We're trying to get actually at some of the things that I think came up when Charlie was alluding to the John Stewart comment about, you know, the reality of commercial support for a media product. How do you think of new funding and business models that will support new ways of distributing in an open environment, high quality, compelling content that reaches an audience? So we decided to try to solve that as well. What it also is, and what's been interesting to see sort of evolve over the last couple of years, is that it's an online community of stations. We have people at these local stations around the country, producers that could be anybody from a high school student producing a bit of audio to a veteran independent producer, and then listeners who've gravitated into this space collaborating to reshape what they think of as the kind of existing public radio structure. And we're talking about the kinds of works that's like, you know, it can be a documentary, it can be things that you hear on public radio, a short feature, a commentary, perhaps after you record your 2.5-minute empathic cases tomorrow as a podcast, we'll stick them up on the site and distribute them out to the nationwide audience as well. And even though we're a nonprofit, we operate very much like a startup, like a technology and media startup. So this is just sort of a screenshot of what you'd get. The idea is that it's almost everything on the site is user created. Like, we actually don't do very much other than format things and put them in categories. All of this, the new pieces that are showing up on the left, the new reviews that have been written by people coming to the site, the newly licensed pieces down on the lower left, that's all activity happening through this network of users of different kinds. In the center column are things that through review and through sort of bubbling up to the surface have become relevant pieces that the primary audience, which is stations looking for things to download and broadcast, would be interested in. So a lot of times that's things that are relevant because of a news story or a holiday or a date peg, but it can be anything. And so this is the rest of sort of resources for any of the users on the site. The reason to create this was actually a collaboration between a group of stations, managers of public radio stations around the country, and independent producers who had increasingly found it difficult to be able to get their work out onto radio. As NPR became a successful mass media enterprise, the opportunities for actually getting on the air were more and more limited. The sound has sort of calcified in a way, or narrowed. At the same time, you have these stations locally who are trying to become the best kind of community institutions that they can, and there was this missing layer of sort of access and distribution in the middle. There was also, and I think that hopefully this is a concept that's become familiar and maybe it's come up in the class, this idea of a long tail in the terms of digital media distribution, where once you now have an efficient way of aggregating media objects and making them available to audiences, it's no longer about just a hit-driven economy where only the things that are able to reach the biggest audience are worth making available, because actually you now find that even niche content has an audience once you're able to make the means of distributing it and reaching that audience much more efficient. And we definitely see that in radio. You know, there's a huge amount of stuff that gets produced and it's broadcast once and then it disappears. You know, it's a great piece. Somebody slaves over an hour-long documentary for 6 months and it goes up on NPR and then it's gone. Sometimes NPR or others will put it on a website, but in terms of actually making it available for additional distribution, it's gone. So this idea of actually making this archive something that will last over time and that value that's sort of embedded in some of those works can emerge once they're accessible is something that we've really discovered and has now become a phenomenon across all media platforms, and one that I think you'll even see if you were tracking the traffic on some of the things that you put up here in the videos. Some of them will end up finding a certain audience based on the availability of the content itself, the fact that it'll bubble up in search, the fact that somebody will recommend it in the blog. Another goal was this idea of diversifying the participation in public radio. The fact is that now the tools of creating, and Steve will be shown to say, the tools of creating audio are so accessible that we have an enormous explosion of who actually is able to produce and get their voices out there in the media. But in terms of actually then connecting that growth of expression to the powerful channels of broad mass media distribution, there's really been a lack of any kind of a means to do that. We do see that through internet channels directly, there's an audience, but there's a missing opportunity if you have this focused public radio audience in place who aren't really hearing the rest of America being reflected in what they hear on the air. And then this opportunity that we also see when you create a platform that involves sort of different user groups and communities to create a new network that bypasses some of the legacy networks that are in place that are much more top-down models. So this, in a sense, is defining a new space where, you know, there's national network models, NPR, PBS, you know, the major commercial networks. There are these local stations, and in public radio, actually, the local community stations are among the last local broadcasters left. You probably know that commercial consolidation of media ownership has meant that in most communities around the country, broadcast television stations and radio stations on the commercial side are being owned by like large national conglomerates. That isn't the case in public radio, which can be sort of a benefit and a difficulty in that every station is still locally managed and owned and operated by a community. There's these producers, and then there are the stations, and we sort of hover in the middle as a platform. We also discovered that these stations in different communities, you've got a station in Woods Hole on Cape Cod, you've got a station out in Monterey, California, you've got a station in Austin, Texas, you've got a station in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. There really wasn't a place for them to share content that they were producing locally. They would produce something of great value. Perhaps they're not aspiring to national distribution, but they created, for example, a wonderful piece about, you know, water resources in their community. And they wanted to be able to share that with other stations where that was an issue in that community. There was no opportunity for that to happen. So creating an actual space for that to work was part of the goal as well. So the way it works in a nutshell, and this is something that actually any of you can participate in, you can sign up and begin to use it in a variety of ways. The members are these producers, stations, and listeners. Anybody can be a producer. You can, as long as you're ready to create some audio and try to put it out there in the marketplace, you're a producer. The stations are primarily these local community, low-power FM, public radio stations, as well as some now internet radio stations and some international broadcasters. We have people in Australia and in the Netherlands and in Ireland and in the UK who are acquiring work from PRX. Anybody can create an account and upload. One of the things, and I think this is a quality of internet media that we are increasingly encountering, it's a sort of a long-tail aspect as well, is the idea of post-filtering. We realized, and when we started, it was just Steve and me in a room, like running this website. We realized if we're going to get thousands of pieces in, we're not going to be sitting there deciding, you know, this one deserves to be on the site, this one doesn't. We're going to put this one here and that one there. We had to just open the gate. And part of the whole point was opening the gate because we weren't going to be the arbiters of what new voices actually should deserve to get onto the air, and we're going to leave that in others' hands. So we created this system of reviewing that would help bubble to the surface things that might match the interests of a particular community and their values. And so there's a review system that's much like an Amazon.com thing where anybody, like a customer review, can rate and review the piece. But there's also an editorial board that we choose kind of a professional roster of people from around public radio to have a tour of duty where they have to review, you know, 8 pieces a month, and those are the featured reviews, and that becomes this kind of professional endorsement on top of this massive audio. And that's enabled, it's where we have now over 11,000 pieces on the site that are getting reviewed and turned around and thin the catalog. The basic way then is for a station who's the primary acquirer of this stuff, a station can log on, can just, search. There's sort of a very easy search mechanism, browse through different categories. They're looking for commentaries. They're looking for documentaries. They're looking for a piece on charter schools, and they can type that in. And they find a piece on charter schools that some producer somewhere had produced. Maybe they produced it a year ago, and it's available on the site. As soon as they find that piece, they can listen to the whole thing, license it on the spot, and download it. They actually download the file for broadcast. And what's, of course, unique about that is that although it counts as a single download, the broadcast is what reaches the big audience. Each of these stations is reaching, in an average quarter hour, tens of thousands of people. So for a producer who's produced this bit of audio, there's this magnifying effect that broadcast still provides. And even though podcasting and sort of direct digital distribution is tapping into new audiences, the pervasive reach of broadcast is still something that's extraordinarily powerful, and that when you can find hybrid ways of tapping the sort of network of the internet and the reach of broadcast, that's something that I think is still early in being explored. 100% of the population has radios. And the radios, you just hit one button and they're on. And public radio is in every community in the country. And so there's a way for that to be still very much of a viable path. And then the economy part of it is that we charge stations. They pay us a fee based on the size of the station. And then we actually pay royalties back to the producers. And this is, to your sort of John Stewart point, who's saying that the beer companies are paying for my show. There has been and is a non-commercial alternative to figuring out how to create, compelling and mass media products that reach a lot of people without having it being based on a commercial model. Public broadcasting has attempted that for years, and it's, if you talk to people in public broadcasting, it's certainly not a model they would advocate for everybody else to adopt, because it's a difficult one, and it's always falling a little short, and it's always dependent on, either it's a government support, it's listener contributions, or it's underwriting, which is often sort of a pseudonym for advertising. But in thinking about a model that might have sort of direct listener contribution to support something that people value, that ties back to a pretty strong theme in public media that may have a great analog in digital social media as it comes to pass. With a nod to the sort of legal domain, the way that we manage the rights is the producer actually manages everything. You own this audio. We expect that you own it. You own the copyright in it. You are uploading it, and you retain that right. This is a non-exclusive arrangement. We're not saying, unlike YouTube, by the way, if you read the user agreement of YouTube, you're giving them absolutely everything and signing off on it forever and ever, and they own it. In PRX, and I think in more of the systems that we're seeing that have a proper balance, the producer owns the audio, and then sets some of the terms and parameters for how it can be used subsequently after it's made available on the site. So you opt in, you basically put it on there and say, I'm willing to give this to public radio stations, and then when new opportunities come, if we, for example, can license it to iTunes for paid download, we'll invite you to opt into that. At which point you have to, of course, have told us that you have cleared all the other appropriate rights in the media that you've uploaded, which, we are not in a position to clear for you or to vet. The buyer, in this case, for the most part, stations, agrees to the terms. They see the terms that you put up there. So when they are ready to get that piece, they're clicking through and licensing it based on your terms. You're notified about it, and all of that's automated. And that really ended up being the only way to make this work. If you had a single station in a small community in Boise trying to go and do a deal with each one of you to try to acquire your 5-minute piece, it would never happen. Not only would it not happen because they just don't have the sales staff or the capacity to do that, but even paying for it, it's a university licensee, they have to invoice the department, it just never works. So part of our whole idea here was to automate and create efficient systems for a new market to emerge, because there wasn't one before. If you create some of these platforms, then suddenly that level of interaction can happen, and the wheels are turning. So for us, of course, I don't know how much any of this stuff has come up, but PRX itself, we're a nonprofit, we're a web service. I had to, you know, sign on the dotted line to be an agent for the DMCA, and I'm on file in, you know, the Library of Congress, so that if anybody claims there's an infringing use of content on PRX, they can notify me, and I have, you know, the safe harbor X number of days to be able to take it down and protect PRX. And then, of course, we had to also get what's called it's multimedia cyber liability insurance. Actually, have this cyber liability insurance. You might look into that, Charlie, for some of the things that you're doing.
I totally need some insurance. In fact, something you just said sent a chill deep through me, because I have just proudly become a YouTube director, which means I have unlimited upload capacity. And I spent a part of the last few days uploading some of my most prized material. You mean I've just given it away?
And did you just go through that, like, scroll?
I went through that like every other thing I go through on the thing.
Yeah, they can do whatever they want with that, now that you've given it to them.
But I can still do whatever I want with it?
Yeah, no, you have not given exclusive rights to them, but you have let them, you know, if they wanted to commercially sell it, if they wanted to edit it, if they wanted to put it X, Y, and Z places.
But if I'm putting it up CC to begin with, that's more power to them.
Right.
Okay, good.
So you should be safe there.
I was suddenly worried I had made a really serious mistake.
You also indemnified them against any possible claims that might come based on what you uploaded.
Hey.
You're used to that.
I'm ready for that.
So this is actually an issue, though, for a lot of producers, especially in radio, because they're used to just producing audio pieces, often using copyrighted music, and not thinking about the rights implications, because for the most part they're putting them on radio, where those are all under a blanket license for broadcast. Suddenly you move it just one hop over onto the internet for download, and all bets are off, and the same musical work that you included in your audio for broadcast is now something that, in theory, you should have cleared permission for, paid some fees for, and so on. And so this is becoming a big issue, and where PRX is in the middle, we're trying to both create sort of easy systems for people to manage those rights and then provide some best practices that help producers sort of wade through that quagmire. What's nice then about the way that this has worked is that we created the platform, and then a lot of times the sort of full life cycle happens without any involvement for us at all. Somebody will join the site, upload a piece of audio, it gets reviewed by one of our reviewers, a station comes on and finds it, auditions it, licenses it, pays for it, downloads it, broadcasts it to hundreds of thousands of people, and we had nothing to do with it. We were just had created the space where that was enabled. And that's now happening thousands of times a month. We have I think over 10,000 pieces have been licensed through this system, reaching millions of listeners. This is an example of just what a piece would look like. So if this group, which is a youth radio group at KRCB called Voice of Youth, they put up a piece here. It's a 7-minute piece. They fill out all this metadata, and it goes into this format. And then a station who might be coming to find it would be able to listen to it. They could write a review of it. They could download audition file of it, or when they're ready to buy it, they click on license and they see the terms and they click through and that's done. And then, boom, the rest of the transactions are automated. Often they're finding things by searching. If you searched, I just searched on cyber to see what would come up. Now they're members and pieces and reviews that relate to almost any topic you could imagine because of the catalog so diverse that we're now able to find a way in on everything, and including some stuff that Charlie's produced and the Berkman Center has done, is available. What's happened, this is the sort of social network aspect of it, is that we now have over 20,000 members in different cities, countries around the world, of all different kinds, of producers and stations and listeners, and they're starting to connect with each other through this to help produce new radio, to come up with opportunities, to figure out how to collaborate. And that's what I think is the exciting part about what we start to see enabled by these web services, where new communities form, including and now increasingly around media production, because that is new. That really is new, where you start to think about media production of audio or video that might reach mass audiences and niche audiences, produced in some collaborative fashion. We have this chart that we like to call the hairball, which is totally out of focus here for some reason, but all we did was took a bunch of the data. This is like stations on PRX buying pieces from other stations. And this just charts their interactions. So each line represents a transaction buying or selling. And these are different nodes. Like if this was in focus, you could see that this, I think, is WNYC in New York. That's a big station. They buy and sell a lot of pieces from other stations. And what we did this to demonstrate was that prior to having this platform, most of these lines didn't exist. There really wasn't a means for these institutions to interconnect in a way or create these nodes of use without having some platform in the space to do it. And then once you begin to see these patterns, you suddenly start to think of different opportunities of collaboration. Beyond just buying and selling existing work, we've had interest from stations saying, well, what if we collaborated with some of these others to put a pool of money together to actually commission a work on something that doesn't exist? What if there was an important issue that really should have an investigative documentary radio piece done about it? Nobody's done it. We can't find it on your site. We can't afford it on our own. We don't have any producers in-house. What if we put it out to this network and found a new way of collaborating to actually create something new as a media product? And that is what I think is next. That's something that's coming in a bunch of different ventures. There's one in particular called newassignment.net that Jay Rosen has started, which is also looking at models like that for collaboration between citizen media creators, professional editors, and new funding mechanisms to say, let's use the power of these web platforms to help actually identify, create, and collaborate around new media. After we sort of start with the public radio stations, which are the first sort of tier of distribution, largely because of where we were founded and also how powerful broadcast remains, we then take a look at other distribution paths. So we're sitting on 10,000 audio pieces in a digital archive. It would be foolish not to think, well, couldn't we make that available in straight digital terms out to people who are using now increasingly digital devices for download and other things? So we do right now, for example, license for paid access to things like Audible.com and to iTunes Music Store, where you actually, the part where you actually buy it for 99 cents. We also do open syndication, where we're experimenting with just licensing things and into open podcasting, where it's available for free. It's syndicated and made available through any directory that might want to list these kinds of bits of content. There's revenue models here, too, which are, for the most part, based on advertising. So as you start to hear more of podcasting emerging, the models that people are looking at are ad-supported for the most part. And then other license opportunities, which could be for educational use and so on. So we have a few examples here where these are actually podcasts created out of the catalog of PRX content. We have one which is all youth-produced media. There's 40 or so youth media groups around the country, high school students who are creating stories on their own, producing things about their own communities and their own lives. And this is, because there's this kind of catch-22 of public radio doesn't cater to a young audience, young audiences don't listen to public radio, putting a youth-produced piece on radio then doesn't serve anybody. One of the ways of getting around that is by looking to podcasting and other means of distribution that might have a chance of reaching beyond that.
So each of these are like podcast channels? Basically?
Yes, that's right.
And someone could take an RSS feed of one of those and it would be there on their machine.
You could
machine.
Subscribe to these and they'd be available on your machine immediately. You could listen to them directly online or put them on your iPod.
It's not 24/7.
Nope.
New audio. What is it?
It's usually once a week. Once a week, and it could be a 5-minute piece or it could be a 10-minute piece. It's actually an interesting fact of podcasting that for the most part you're talking about episodic delivery of these files. Somebody starts a new podcast, and it's not a 24/7 internet stream. They're just sending you one file every now and then. Sometimes daily, sometimes weekly. And I think there's actually big opportunities in those spaces between those episodes that we haven't talked about yet. But this is just the beginning because we have this big catalog of content and we're looking at a model that this one actually most closely follows where here we are sitting on these works from all these different diverse producers. And most of them aren't in a position to actually produce their own podcast on a weekly basis. They might have one excellent piece that they put on or three pieces that they put on. But in this model with the Nature Stories podcast, the Nature Conservancy, which has a big web presence, wanted to have some original content, but didn't know how to produce their own podcast. They sponsored a host, a curator, to come into PRX, choose pieces on environmental topics, and create a podcast out of that. So it basically becomes a kind of thematic slice through the catalog where it's an external funder, an external host, licensing things from a variety of producers in the catalog and then putting it out as a single feed. And that's a wonderful mix of actually the kinds of assets you can bring to bear. We did this thing which you actually can still get through tomorrow, which is the Scream Stream. It's all the Halloween pieces. You know, this is the long tail demonstration because we went through the site. We've got like 50 hours of amazing Halloween stories. And rather than just wait for stations to license them and put them on broadcast, which they are doing, we decided to create a flash player that would just play this as a continuous stream. You can skip around and listen to things, but it also will just play for 8 hours straight. And it's a syndicated thing. It's like, you know how on YouTube you can take a bit of code and embed the video in your blog post? This is embeddable in anybody's site. And so we've now seen dozens of stations and blogs start to embed this in their site just for the week of Halloween. And that's an experiment in a different kind of open distribution of this content. As I said, we do sell stuff as well, like looking for sustainable revenue that will go back for us to sustain our operations and revenue for the producers. So here's a PRX piece that we actually have for sale on iTunes. So just to sort of wind up here, we've got about 400 stations and 1,500 producers and 17,000 listeners and about 11,000 pieces. And this is over the last couple of years. It's really kind of swamped in as we started to extend the invitation out to others. Over 10,000 pieces have been licensed, and 10,000 downloads could be a lot in a certain web environment, but when you then multiply it by the broadcast number of who's actually hearing those when the station puts them on the air, we're reaching millions of people. And that's the exciting part, that is the hybrid of reaching into the broadcast reach with an internet service. And then we've paid out about $250,000 in royalties based on the use of that work. Not enough probably for Jon Stewart to switch over to distributing his show on a service like this, but it does demonstrate that there is a way of creating new intermediaries that aggregate dollars in a different fashion and make some sort of a viable distribution path available. And that's about 650 different content providers who've participated in this, including complete amateurs. You know, we've had students who've put work up and gotten broadcast on WBEZ in Chicago. And then we've had, people who produced work 20 years ago that have revived it, put it into the archive, and made it available and gotten picked up by broadcast as well.
So if we produce some good stuff out of here, we could get it up on PRX?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And Steve knows how to upload. He's very good at that.
Give us the three most important features of a good piece of work as far as you're concerned for PRX.
Well, it should fit, if you're intending it for broadcast, radio stations have clocks. They like to put things on that are either an hour long or that are short so they could fit in these little, what they call, cutaways within existing shows. If you ever listen to Morning Edition or All Things Considered, you hear that there's these short pieces that they do. That's where a station is going to play something that would be 2.5 minutes long. If you produce something like 19 minutes long, it's really difficult for a station to find a home for it. Often it's, you know, an hour.
So optimal time would be 2.5 minutes?
Well, optimal time would be in that cutaway length, which would be 2 to 5 minutes. Or an hour.
Forget an hour.
If you got all the pieces together, maybe you could cobble together an hour.
Well, don't forget an hour. Who knows? You guys make it for an hour.
And then it has to be good. You know, for a station to pick it up, it's just got to sound good. It's got to, you know, the audio quality has to be decent enough. But more importantly, it's got to be compelling audio. It's got to tell a story or it's got
to
have a point.
I'll
show you the core values. I'll skip ahead a little bit here, Charlie, because I remember you liked these from before.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
There's this, the public radio program directors. The program directors are the gatekeepers of public radio. They're the ones who work at the stations and decide what gets on the air, and they have an association called the PRPD, the Public Radio Program Directors. And a few years ago, they did a study where they did focus groups of listeners around the country trying to understand, for the people who do listen to public radio, who love it and are big supporters of it, what is it that they are listening for? Like, what do they like about it? What draws them to it? Why do they support it? And so they actually, you know, went and conjured up the vocabulary. They taped these people, you know, in multiple communities and multiple groups around the country, and a sort of coherent set of terms ended up emerging from it that they then codified in a way and said, these are the core values of public radio. Core values as reflected in our core listeners, which there's a bit of an asterisk to that I'll explain. But it's interesting to read through because you do start to see both what that kind of filter is, and if you're thinking about what would make a good piece and why would it get on the radio, this is one of the filters. So love of lifelong learning, substance, curiosity, credibility, accuracy, honesty, respect for the listener, and purpose. These are under the qualities of the mind category. They have qualities of the heart and spirit. Idealism, we believe in our power to find solutions. Humor, inspired about public life and culture. Civility, belief in civil discourse, and generosity. And then there are these qualities of craft. Uniquely human voice, conversational, authentic, and intimate. Attention to detail, the music, the sound, the elements, the language, and the pacing. If you, they actually have core values checklists.
You've just solved the problem for me. Those are my grading criteria.
I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I had no idea. The trick with this, and the reason actually we decided early on when we set up the review system not to have a checklist of these things, partly because we knew people weren't going to sit there and check things off online, but partly because this reflects the core values of public radio as public radio currently sounds. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And one of our reasons for being was actually to expand the sound of public radio beyond what has become a kind of core reaching a certain audience that's inhibiting it from doing something different. I would say that if you took this list of core values and ran The Daily Show or Colbert Show by it, there's a bunch of them that would not line up. There's a few of them that really would.
Which one wouldn't?
Well, I think some of
authenticity.
Yeah, well, inspired about public life and culture. I think one of the things that is missing from these is like irony, cynicism, a certain kind of sarcastic humor. Those are things that you don't hear on public radio because they're not part of the core value list, but they are certainly the drivers of shows like The Daily Show, and they work like magic. And that's something I actually miss as a big fan of Comedy Central and a big listener of public radio. The chasm there is palpable. I mean, you really don't get any of that. And I think one of it is this is a limiting filter that doesn't allow certain things like that on the air. And I'd like to see that change. So we actually have been thinking of what are the fringe values of public radio. Let's come up with a fringe list and see if we could start to get that.
Well, I like
on
your
the air.
Amendments. I like your amendments.
Yeah.
Jay, can we open up for questions?
Yeah, of course.
Yes. Go, Anita.
I have a question about your marketing strategies. Mm-hmm. How do people learn about these? How do they get in touch with you?
Well, for the first couple years of this, most of what we were doing was internal to the public radio system. So, within the world of public radio, which is a small community, it's a small industry reaching a big audience. But as a small community, you really only have a few hundred stations and a few thousand producers. So our strategy was to be there, meet all of those people one by one, and tell them about what we were doing. So from the early days, we would go to every conference where public radio people would gather. We would start to do these kinds of presentations. And we didn't, and we don't, have like a big marketing budget where we're putting up ads anywhere. It's been very much a word-of-mouth service that very quickly spread within the small world of public radio, which got us to a kind of critical mass where then, because stations can reach a much bigger audience, listeners started to hear about us and start to roll in. There's a lot of traffic that we get just from people searching things in Google, where if you are searching a term, and we've been surprised to see how high we come up on these results, you might be searching a term or searching for an artist like Ani DiFranco, and there's a documentary about Ani DiFranco on our site, an interview with her and a performance of hers. And if you search for her, PRX comes up like fifth. And that has started to bring in a whole kind of completely new audience that we aren't reaching through any direct means into it. And we found that those ways of interconnecting just through other people's kind of viral distribution has been our best marketing tool.
So supposing I'm an internet radio station or a blogger, how can I license one of these things to put on my site? And also, is there some way is it connected with Creative Commons or something where it says where you, whether you can make derivative works of the things?
Yes. We will probably have the ability for directly licensing stuff by the end of the year. The trick for us had been that every piece was automatically assumed to be available for radio stations, but each producer has some different decisions to make about whether they want to make it for open net distribution. And so as a pure technical matter, we hadn't yet built the engine that could let them opt in to, say, let a blogger license my piece or put it out for under complete open Creative Commons license. And we're finally going to be able to do that because we have the space for them to do it, but we still wanted to leave that up to each individual without sort of enforcing a blanket license across the entire catalog. We decided there was an interesting wrinkle in the Creative Commons decision, which is we decided not to use Creative Commons because we needed a custom license that fit public radio business models, and we were writing it at the time Creative Commons was launching. But there's a wrinkle in Creative Commons, which is that if you put your work under a Creative Commons non-commercial license, because broadcast radio stations and even NPR, a $100 million major mass media company, is non-commercial, they could take it without any other, payments being made or rights being offered, even though the license was actually intended for individuals for like peer-to-peer file sharing. So that's something that we actually needed to create our own license to accommodate. But the answer is yes, and we actually now have a few podcasters who are coming to the site licensing pieces to use in their podcasts. We have international broadcasters coming, and then hopefully then a blogger would be able to basically sign up, see what's been opted in for their use, and be able to use it.
Jake, would you introduce Steve?
Steve Schultz. So Steve and I really were the ones who founded PRX. Steve was a technical director from the beginning and helped create the initial. This was all built on open source software. We had originally had these developers in Russia writing the code and eventually built this up to a much bigger enterprise. Steve has since moved on to the comparative media studies program at MIT. But he and I together last year helped pull together a really interesting conference at the Berkman Center called Beyond Broadcast, Reinventing Public Media in a Participatory Culture, where we're really trying to say, you know, we've had this public broadcasting sector. We now have this explosion of sort of social media and participatory culture. Where do they fit? Because it's no longer this dichotomy between a commercial media sector and a public media sector. There's now this third zone that is really changing the rules. And is there an opportunity for public broadcasting to help influence a public interest media phenomenon in the sort of social media space that's coming through? So that's probably not what you were going to talk about, but I'll let you do it anyway.
No, and that's in the right direction. And also, Charlie, feel free to steer me wherever you wish. I'm not going to start with that yet. Okay. I was just going to talk for a little bit about what came out of Beyond Broadcast. So like Jake said, Beyond Broadcast was a conference this past year co-organized by Berkman and several other groups to look at issues surrounding this transition from what's essentially a broadcast one-to-many media landscape to something that's much more peer-to-peer and network-based like we've been talking about here and like Vankler talks about in quite a bit of detail. In particular, we were doing this with public broadcasters who bring sensibilities that are unique to the public broadcasting space. And that's why I think tying this conversation in with PRX is so helpful, because when you look at themes like Jake is discussing here and the sort of values that have traditionally been part of public broadcasting, they reflect very explicitly a notion of public interest that we've been sort of working with as a country and also more globally for quite a while. What does it mean to have media that serves the public good, whether or not it's commercial or non-commercial? How do we understand the public interest? I think a really interesting way of examining that question is looking at it from a regulatory perspective and taking that history of media regulation to try to distill some of what the values were behind it. And we're at a particularly interesting moment right now in terms of media regulation, very, very active area. There's essentially the rewrite of the telecommunications bill is passed the House. and is in the Senate right now, and the big question is whether or not it'll be passed in a lame duck before before the Senate splits, and this coming election will have a huge amount of effect on that. There's a raging network neutrality debate, which is essentially the common carrier debate of the network sphere, whether or not all players on the network should be treated equal, whether or not all packets have a right to get through at the same speed, or if Comcast owns your network, can they say you have to use our version of iTunes or RSS and not individual bloggers' versions? And then there are interesting things going on right now in terms of antitrust issues and merger issues. Within a few days, probably the FCC will decide whether or not AT&T can repurchase Bell South and what the terms of that merger will be, and one of those will be network neutrality. Now, to understand all those in context and part of the sphere that PRX lives in, which is, in the United States at least, quite separated from the world of commercial media by design, it's helpful to look at some of the history for how that regulation developed and the spheres in which we tried to understand it. Going back to radio, back in the 20s, when the first Radio Act of 27 passed, the big need was, one of the big needs was to let all of the individual participants be able to speak without interfering with each other's speech. And at this stage, there was no regulation in terms of how you could, what frequency you transmit on, and how you deal with issues where people have interference. So the big term for that sort of phase of regulation was scarcity of spectrum. And part of the notion that developed out of that was this notion of trusteeship. So the government said, we decide what who gets to use what media when in the interest of letting everyone speak as freely as possible. And we entrust this public resource, which is the airwaves. It's a public good in the sense of it's a good that can only be utilized well and maybe only created in a reasonable way if everyone agrees to work together, and typically the government manages it. So scarcity. And then through the 80s, there was sort of a change. So public broadcasting.
Steve, let me just hold you up.
Sure.
I'm very eager for you to get to the Pro Tools.
Yes.
And I'm running out of time.
Yes.
So
all right.
I want to
very excited.
Push ahead on it. Here's the thought.
Yes.
The thought is, internet technology is a wildly disruptive technology.
Yes.
And there's a ton of law that gets generated in its wake.
Yes.
As established interests try and fight and legislate and do all that stuff. That's Cyber 2.
Yes.
That's Zittrain.
Yes.
This one's looking forward. I want to. The idea is, in Cyber 1, learn how to make an argument, understand the media, so that you know how to get it out. This is the
sure.
court of public opinion.
So the very accelerated version of this, which is the setup to what I'm going to show here, is that the argument for what the public's role is in media and how it owns it has been shaped various ways over time. We're at a critical moment where we're going from one to many, to many to many, and that gives us an opportunity to re-examine what our core values are. To that end, I'm going to show you two things at once. One is sort of the technique of audio editing, and I'm not going to get into it deep at all because Colin is going to show you the details of it, but I want to give you a taste of it. And simultaneously sort of an example of an argument that I've constructed in this space, which maybe you can tell me whether or not you think it reflects empathic argument or not. Should this be on right now?
So just while you're getting this up, one of the things that's really striking about this is the contrast between this and what we and the community television content that we talked about earlier in the semester. And it seems like you guys are having, and public radio in general, is having a lot more success than community television is in terms of putting out content that large numbers of people actually want to hear, right, which makes a big difference in the court of public opinion. And I was just wondering if you guys had anything to say about the difference between those two.
Between public radio and community television?
Yeah.
Public access television?
Yeah.
Well, part of it is that public radio, to its benefit and its detriment, really decided to focus on craft and had, media products and become a mass media broadcaster. And it's a hit-driven kind of thing. So, the success of reaching 30 million people is on the backs of certain programs and personalities that are what you'd, imagine would be necessary to start to have a highly compelling, entertaining product, as opposed to something that says, as a kind of prerequisite, which I gather is a public access television thing, that we're going to let first come, first serve. Anybody can kind of be part of the media creation process. It's more about the enabling of creators than it is about serving an audience with a specific product. So the trade-off is that, now public radio has established this great presence, but it's thereby narrowed its sort of embrace of more voices. And that's been an explicit trade-off. And there's a question now as to whether there's a way to harness the success of what's happened in the sort of very focused mass media broadcast terms by letting the internet space be the place where a lot more diversity of voices could be there, connecting with the engaged audiences of public radio. That is that trade-off. When you create a show, it costs tens of millions of dollars to create. All things considered, it's like a staff of 60 people working hard on 2 hours of audio a day, and it's that kind of reliability and high quality that has created an audience for it, and that's something that's not easy to achieve if you're trying to at the same time be incredibly democratic about the process. I think that's a continuous trade-off. I think we'll see when we're trying to figure out how to make use of the tools and the platforms for media that might end up reaching somebody.
The other public space, sort of public space that's interesting to me, like public radio, in that it's not dominated by major corporations, is college radio. Mm-hmm. Has PRX given any thought to somehow a PRX of college radio?
I actually went on last Wednesday to St. Louis for the College Media Conference, which is a combination of print and broadcast college media organizations, the students who are involved in them, and the faculty that advise them. And there's 2,000 people at this thing. College radio, for the most part, almost all of it is dominated by students spinning records. Which is great for the student. I mean, it's mainly a music-driven format, and each person gets a show. And one of the hardest things is that, of course, semester to semester, it's a different group of people who are doing the shows or who are managing the stations. It's very hard to even have a relationship with an institution when a college radio station is often much more like a sandbox of creativity for people interested in music. There's a subset of the stations that's a growing one that are actually interested in public affairs and news and are producing content and are licensing some stuff from PRX, and we have a handful of college radio stations already both contributing and licensing stuff from us. But that's a bit of a struggle because of the way in which college stations have operated. And you'd be surprised at how distanced the college radio stations usually are from the academic setting that they're in. And the sort of, potential confluence of wow, you've got this amazing academic setting and this great public interest and this sort of resources of the academy. But then the student-run station is all... ambient electronica and the punk show and stuff that I listen to in Boston constantly. I love the shows, but in terms of the capacity to turn it into another tier of engaging in the community, it's an uphill battle.
Steve, so very briefly, I think the tool that Colin is going to show you will be substantially less complex than this, but I want to introduce you to the notion of sort of multi-track audio editing. The idea is that the beginning is on the left, and you move towards the right. And each of these tracks here are different pieces that I've layered in. Now, depending on how you choose to do your assignment, you may never have to worry about this at all if you're simply giving a speech. And you may want to trim off the beginning or the end if you have bumps or notes or things you don't want to include like that. But the more the more complex, fully featured audio editing involves layering things together. This particular project I did for a class at MIT where I wanted to make the case that it's important to closely consider some of these regulations around many-to-many technologies now, that despite the fact that the internet is very liberating from the network perspective, that it connects us to many other people and allows us to have conversations across all sorts of borders, that there are limitations and that there are potential risk areas. And so what I did was, rather than constructing the narrative myself, selected bits and pieces, clips of people who had spoken on the topic, and tried to assemble it into an argument where I first say, yes, there is a great deal of potential in the internet. There are all these fantastic things that are happening. Here are some people speaking about it. But here is sort of the reality on the other side. I don't know if I want to play this whole thing. Okay, it's 6 minutes, so we can fit it. But did you want to fit other things in the end?
No, I think maybe it's a fitting conclusion. Let's
do okay.
It. We get to watch it scroll. Yeah. When you play it?
Sorry, what?
Do you get to watch it scroll across when you play it?
Yeah.
Cool.
And what are these different tracks?
The top one is a music track. Actually, the top two are music tracks that I mixed together. And the bottom two are spoken word clips, which I will... I'll show you who it is that's speaking as it happens. I have to relaunch this just a second, but it will take not a moment. So this is the music track. I'm exercising some fair use there.
The sound of the human voice. Our time is a time for crossing barriers, for erasing old pathways, for groping around.
Signing of the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967.
It can illuminate, and yes, it can even inspire. The insatiable appetite for programming material. And then you have a situation where a blog can take on a cable news network.
Is with the exponential leap in technology, the human voice, the voice itself, we hear less and less. We have the robotic imitation of it, you see.
How long did it take to make this, Steve?
Maybe 10 or 15 hours to find the clips and 10 or 15 hours to edit.
Technology are going to make it possible to get over onto a new technological base for intellectual efforts before our ponderous social processes will last. I think more people ought to get in there and think about the social process.
Cool.
How will you post this as an MP3?
Sure.
All right. We should do it.
Cool. I will post it.
All right, thoughts, questions, observations?
anyway. Charlie, I have a question. Why radio? Why audio?
I haven't got a mic, so.
Oh, sorry.
Get on one.
You just stand there, Jake.
Yeah. Audio is the most penetrating medium. Jake said it. It's like when you think about the potential of internet in the developing world, the idea of an integrated media space. If you go the whole way with the idea of cyberspace as a rhetorical space made of human nodes of consciousness that are linked in integrated media, radio is the most penetrating medium for getting message out. And so it just is at the base. You can layer on top of it. As you build message, the number one rule, technologically speaking, is audio is what counts the most. If you're shooting video, audio counts the most. If you haven't got good audio, you haven't got a good product. And it's really tough to get sometimes.
Also, this is doable for all of you. I mean, you have a computer. It's got a built-in microphone. You can talk for 2.5 minutes to your computer and create this podcast. And if you want to spend a lot of time, you can spend 6 hours or 10 hours turning it into a beautiful audio production. But just at the base, you can get a very good production just doing what you can do with the tools that you have right now. And knowing what you're going to know after we do our little workshop tomorrow.
Yeah, I didn't mean to overwhelm people. It can be very simple and straightforward. I've done it with a couple of classes of undergrads, actually, at MIT. As soon as they get in there and start playing with it, it's like something snaps, and they come out with beautiful stuff. So I'm sure you guys are going to be an order of magnitude better.
All right, so thank you all very much. Class
Thank you.